سر به دوکان پری جنرال ساهی تاکی که چه ایتونی دیدم شیو آنها کشن پرم سهم نرمانی تان شیو شکم بیتان شیو آم نمو بگبته و سره و آیا This is June 14th, 2009 in Auckland, and we're reading from Canto 6, Chapter 9, Text 37. Sama vishama matinam matam anusarasi yata rajukandaha sarpaditiyam. Sama. Equal or proper. Vishama. And unequal or mistaken. Matinam. Of those having intelligence. Matam. Conclusion. Anusarasi. You follow. Yata. Just as. Rajukandaha. A piece of rope. Sarpa adi. A snake. Diyan. Of those who perceive. So this is again the demigod speaking to the Lord. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. A rope causes fear for a bewildered person who considers it a snake, but not for a person with proper intelligence who knows it to be only a rope. Similarly, you, as a supersoul in everyone's heart, inspire fear or fearlessness according to one's intelligence, but in you there is no duality. So what are the demigods comparing the Lord to? They're saying the Lord is like a? People see him as a snake, and he is actually a? Like a? Like a rope. They're saying the Lord is like a rope, but some people perceive him to be like a snake. So have you ever had the experience of mistaking one thing for another and becoming frightened? There was a... In America, there was a temple we lived by where we were about a five-minute walk from the temple, so we'd walk to Mangal Artik every day. And sometimes, if it was foggy, there was a sign, a road sign, that would look like a person. You know, you'd think, oh, there's some person waiting for me at the side of the road. So this thing of mistaking something benign, something harmless, for something frightening is a universal experience. Although, I don't think I've ever mistaken a rope for a snake. Specifically that, but something where you see something and you think, oh, it's frightening, and then when you examine it closely and find out what it really is, you find out that it's actually harmless. So the demigods are saying that the Lord is exactly like this, that really he's harmless, he's benign, beyond harmless, of course, he's beneficial, but that people perceive him differently according to their intelligence. Purport. In Bhagavad Gita 4.11, the Lord says... What's Prabhupada going to quote here? Yes, very good. Ye tamam prapajante tamstatai vabhajam yaham, which means? That's right. As one surrenders unto me, I reward him accordingly. So why is Prabhupada quoting this in relationship to this verse?
Because Prabhupada wants to say that if we surrender, Krishna will show us that he is like a rope, and if we don't surrender, it is like a snake, those who are non-devotees.
Yes, that God is going to be perceived differently according to our degree of surrender. That the difference in our perception of Krishna comes from where? From him? From us. From how we're dealing with him. And we see this even among ordinary persons. You know, if you come to a person's door with a plate of prasada, they'll react differently than if you come to their door with pointing a gun at them. And their difference in reaction depends on how you're approaching them. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is the reservoir of everything, including all knowledge, all truth, and all contradictions. The example cited herein is very appropriate. A rope is one truth, but some mistake it for a snake, whereas others know it to be a rope. Similarly, devotees who know the Supreme Personality of Godhead do not see contradictions in him, but non-devotees regard him as a snake-like source of all fear. What example do you think Prabhupada is going to give? I'm going to give an example where a devotee saw Krishna as benevolent and a non-devotee saw Krishna as a source of all fear at the same time. Very nice. For example, when Nrisimhadeva appeared, Prahlad Maharaj saw the Lord as a supreme solace, whereas his father, a demon, saw him as the ultimate death. So solace means shelter. Like for the little child, the mother is the solace. There in the rainstorm, the room you stay in is your solace. So the same Krishna, the same Nrisimhadeva, Prahlad Maharaj is saying, oh, here's my shelter, here's my protector. And the demon is saying, oh, here is death personified. I actually had a very strange example of this years ago. We got this little boy in our school, maybe 6 years old. And one day on the playground, he threatened to kill one of the other children. He threatened to strangle him with a rope that he had in his pocket. So it was a whole scene. And we had to try to take the rope away from him, and he tried to run away from the school, and it was a mess. Anyway, one of the teachers said, you know, legally you're required to inform the police in a situation like this, if one child tries to kill another child. So, okay, you know, so we called the police. We weren't sure what to do. We called the police. And as soon as the police got there, the child became completely calm, and he had been, like, running away from school and yelling at everybody. As soon as the police came, he became completely calm and completely happy, and the whole situation was resolved for the moment. It ended up causing other problems down the road. But I was just thinking, why would just seeing a policeman immediately make this child feel pacified? Well, later I found out that this child's father was very abusive, and he would beat up the mother and the child, and that when the police would come, they would save them. So that made me understand, first of all, why this child was threatening to kill other children. But it also helped me to understand why this child saw the police. He didn't see the policeman as a threat. He didn't think, oh, now the policeman's come, he's going to put me in jail, he's going to punish me. He thought, oh, here's the police. They're my savior. They're my shelter. So when Nrisimhadeva comes, you know, like the real heavy-duty universal police chief, Prahlad Maharaj is thinking, oh, he's my shelter. He's going to take care of me. And he didn't see his own father. Normally a child sees his father as a shelter. Well, I didn't see his father as a shelter. Whereas the criminal, when he sees the police officer, he's thinking, uh-oh, now I'm in trouble. As stated in Srimad Bhagavatam 11.2.37, Bayam dvitya bini veshita syat. Bini is separate. Dvita is two. Fear results from being absorbed in duality. That's a very interesting statement. Fear results from being absorbed in duality. When one is in knowledge of duality, one knows both fear and bliss. The same Supreme Lord is a source of bliss to the devotees and fear to the non-devotees who have a poor fund of knowledge. God is one, but people understand the absolute truth from different angles of vision. The unintelligent see contradictions in him, but sober devotees find no contradictions. Samavisamamatinam matamanu sarasi yatarajukanda sarpadidiyam. A rope car is a sphere for a bewildered person who considers it a snake, but not for a person with proper intelligence who knows it to be only a rope. Similarly, you as a super soul in everyone's heart inspire fear or fearlessness according to one's intelligence, but in you there is no duality. So here the demigods are talking about that if one factually knows Krishna, one will be situated in fearlessness. We'll be situated in fearlessness. Other words for fearlessness are peace. If you're fearless, you're going to be very peaceful. Also, if you're fearless, that means you have one of the great virtues, which we've discussed before at the Loft, called courage. And it's interesting that of all of the virtues, honesty, charity, cleanliness, kindness, forgiveness, the demons really like courage. I mean, it's not only something that the devotees like. Everybody respects courage. Not everybody respects honesty. Some people are glorified for being dishonest, isn't it? Among thieves, the most dishonest person is going to be glorified. Or I've heard today that in the media there's so many television shows and movies where the hero is a dishonest person, is some kind of a criminal. And not everybody values the idea of forgiveness. Sri Prahlad was speaking about forgiveness at the loft on Wednesday. But most people, actually, I'd say, don't value forgiveness. Of course, they want to be forgiven, but they don't really value forgiveness when it's going the other way. People are generally much more interested in vengeance. And not everybody values cleanliness. Not everyone values mercy. Not everyone values kindness. Not everybody values self-control. In fact, in our materialistic society, many people will deride such qualities. Oh, you want to be clean? You want to be self-controlled? You want to be merciful? But nobody will deride courage. Is there anyone who glorifies cowardice? Anybody? Even the biggest demon, do they glorify cowardice? You find throughout the Shastra that even the, you know, biggest demons, they want to feel courageous. They want to feel fearless. And courage or fearlessness or peace is really the essence of all of the other virtues. Just like it's said in the Bhagavatam that a non-devotee cannot possess any good qualities. And there's other places, of course, where Prabhupada says that non-devotees certainly have many good qualities. And when we read that verse, we may think, well, you know, I know a lot of non-devotees who have some good qualities. In fact, I know some non-devotees who have some better good qualities than some of the members of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Would you all agree with that statement? So, you know, we read this in the Bhagavatam and we're thinking, yeah, it doesn't seem to add up. In fact, I remember a book one of the parents of my students lent me for our school. And I was reading about this woman who had been persecuted under the Soviet regime for being a Christian. And she was a million times more merciful and forgiving than I am. It was very embarrassing, actually, to read about her incredible good qualities. So we see so many people have so many good qualities. So why does it say they don't have good qualities? Because unless you have complete courage, fearlessness, and peace, there's a certain point at which you will give up your good quality. You know, I recently experienced where I was trying to help some devotees who were arguing with each other, and the devotees were saying, oh, that person really, they don't really care about Krishna. Oh, they don't really care about Krishna. Oh, they don't really, they just want money, or they just want power, or they just want this, or they don't really care about Prabhupada. Everybody was saying that about everybody. Basically, you know, person A would say, well, I really want to serve Krishna, but you don't. And then this person would say, well, I really want to serve Krishna, but you don't. So I was talking to them about being charitable and being forgiving and being, you know, merciful and seeing the good in everybody. Right? Is that all good qualities? And then I ended up, and I was really praying, Krishna, you know, please help me to show these devotees how to just be appreciative of one another. And even when I gave my little talk on Tamal Krishna Maharaj yesterday, I was talking about appreciating all the devotees. Right? And then Krishna put me in a circumstance where somebody was criticizing me, and all of a sudden I couldn't be appreciative anymore. All of a sudden I'm thinking, why are you attacking me? You're a nonsense. I was developing the same mentality I was criticizing, so I was really meditating on this. Why am I doing that? I thought it's out of fear. I'm afraid, you know, if this devotee doesn't like me, maybe they'll go around telling everybody how bad I am and I'll lose my community. They'll say, oh, no, we don't want you here anymore. You're doing this and that and the other thing, and, you know, get out. Or I'm afraid even, you know, I won't have a place to stay and I'll have to be out in the rain like the cows, you know, and I'll be cold. And due to that fear, I gave up my good quality. So that's the tipping point. You know, devotees ask all the time, how can I be steady in Krishna consciousness? How can I keep my ecstasy? You know, I have an experience of ecstasy and peace. How do I keep it? And the way you keep it is you don't have any fear. Because we can keep the good quality until something threatens us, and then it's gone. You know, would any of us say that we're absolutely honest? And what's the point at which we would give up our honesty? When we would feel threatened enough that we would think, you know, being dishonest is worth it if I can protect whatever it may be that we want to protect. Our relationship with somebody, or our money, or our residence, or something. So only the devotee can have good quality because the devotee is always fearless. The devotee always has peace, right? Under all circumstances. Therefore, the devotee is always happy. Just like, usually have the Bhagavad Gita up here. Thank you, Krishna. So one of the really nice verses in Bhagavad Gita. One who is not connected with the Supreme in Krishna consciousness can have neither transcendental intelligence nor a steady mind, without which there's no possibility of peace. And how can there be any happiness without peace? So if I'm filled with fear, which is cowardice, cowardice means that out of fear, I'm not willing to do the right thing. I'm going to do something that I think is going to benefit my immediate interest instead of what's right. Then how can I be happy? It's actually impossible. And I'm going to be seeing, as it says here, dvitva bina. I'm going to be seeing things as separate. Okay, this person is a friend. This person is an enemy. This is a safe situation. This is a scary situation. And that my mind is always going to be accepting and rejecting. Is this a safe situation? Is this a scary situation? Oh, it's a scary situation. Okay, I better protect myself. Oh, it's a safe situation. Okay, now I can be a nice person. Now I can be charitable and forgiving. And how can I be happy then? Because even when I'm feeling so-called safe, there's always some underlying fear. Is it really safe? Always, the mind's always checking. Can I accept? Can I reject? Can I accept? Can I reject? And fear or courage is also the basis of making all good decisions. So it's the basis of all good qualities. It's the basis of happiness. One has to have peacefulness and courage and fearlessness in order to be happy. In order to make any good decisions, I have to be fearless. Can you make good decisions out of fear? Is that possible? So why do we have so much fear? What is it coming from? Well, all throughout the scriptures it says this fear comes from this duality, from identifying with the body, from identifying with the world. From maya, from seeing things that are not, like here it's saying, seeing the Lord as something fearful. Seeing the Lord as malevolent. Thinking that my basis for enjoyment is in the things of this world. Prabhupada also says, worrying about the future. What's going to happen? What's going to happen? What's going to happen? And if you're in duality and think you're the body, there's a lot to worry about the future, isn't there? What's the future hold for you if you think that you're the body? Well, definitely death. And death's kind of scary, isn't it? Everything I think that's my identity, which is all my memories of this life, where I was born, who my parents are, where I went to school, everything that creates my identity, it's all going to be gone. And then who knows where I'm going to go? I don't know if I'll be a nice little kid like that sitting in the temple room. I don't know what kind of parents I'm going to get. I don't know what kind of schooling I'm going to get. I don't know how people are going to treat me. And I'll have to build up my identity and all my possessions all over again. That's pretty scary. And that is the future for everybody. What to speak of old age? Any of us here who are old like old age? Is it fun? And disease? Right? If everyone, Bibi Govinda Maharaj just posted something about how he went to China and they were so afraid of the swine flu that they were bringing in this device to take the temperature of every single person on the plane before they let them off the plane. They brought up like this ray gun and stuck it to their forehead, you know, what's your temperature? And then they were taking videos of everybody on the plane, so if anybody snuck in with, you know, the disease, they could find them again. And he said one boy had a high temperature. And he was within six rows of this boy. So they took them all into a special quarantine place. He said people came to get, they kept them on the plane after everybody else went off. And then when they got off the plane, the people who received them were dressed in like spacesuits. You know, they looked like aliens from Mars. And they were taken to a special quarantine place. And, you know, so there's going to be disease. There's going to be disease. There's going to be old age. Or if it's not, if you die early, I guess there's no old age. But then there's going to be death. And then there's going to be anxieties, there's going to be distress from other living entities, there's going to be pouring rain that goes right through your raincoat. You know, those things are going to happen. You're going to lose all your money in the stock market. Your house may burn down. Your car may have an accident. So this fear comes from constant worry about the future. What's going to happen? What's going to happen? What's going to happen? This person I'm marrying, are they going to be nice? Are they going to stay with me? You know, this child I'm having, is it going to be a good child? Is this house going to stay here? Is this community still going to be here? Is the government still going to be here? Will there be a war? Well, you know, will my job work out? Constantly worrying about the future because we're identifying with this world. Now, what's the cure? How do we cure this? I mean, of course, many materialistic people, they're so accustomed to being in fear, they don't even A, recognize that they're in fear, or B, even think about a cure. You know, if you don't have a disease, you don't think about curing it. So, just like I might have told you this before, but one place in America, we lived right by the train tracks. And the first night, when the train went by, it woke me up, and after that, I just never noticed it anymore. You become accustomed to it. So one time we had visitors from California. They were sitting on the deck of the house and we were talking. And as we were talking, a train went by. And all of a sudden they became completely silent. I said, "What's the matter?" They said, "Do you just sit calmly during earthquakes?" Because in California there's a lot of earthquakes. But I didn't even notice it anymore. So in the same way, there's this constant fear that's there for all the conditioned souls. But basically, people are not even aware of it. It just becomes background noise. You know, the people who live in a big city, you know, where the cars are honking and people are screaming, they don't even hear it anymore. They're not even aware of it. Or like here, you see all the stars at night. That's rare now in the world. People don't, they never see the stars. Or when I was in China, I didn't even see the sky at all. It was all just kind of this cotton candy. Right? But people become accustomed to it. It just becomes normal for them. So for the conditioned soul, having a state of fear is just normal. But as we take the Krishna consciousness, we start to be aware that I have this fear. I have this underlying fear. I'm basically in a state of cowardice, more or less, all of the time. All right, so how do we cure this? Well, first of all, as far as this anxiety about the future, we offer Krishna the results of our work. Is that a recurrent theme in the Bhagavad Gita? Offer Krishna the results of your work, offer Krishna the results. What does that mean exactly? I mean, of course you can say that means, all right, I go to a job and I earn $1,000 and I use 500 of it for worship of the deity and for distributing prasadam and for various spiritual things. So I give Krishna the results of my work in that way. Or it can mean I go to school and I learn how to be an engineer and so then I create a building for Krishna. But it also means letting go of the results of your work. You have a right to perform your prescribed duties, but you're not entitled to the fruits of action. Never consider yourself to be the cause of the results of your activities and never be attached to not doing your duty. So there was one time I was engaged in a mediation in a temple and I was speaking to one of the expert mediator gurus in our movement, Vrajabihari Prabhu, and he said, "You have to be very detached. You have to be completely neutral." I said, "Well, I'm neutral as far as I don't think that one side is right and one side is wrong." He said, "Yes, but you have to be neutral as to the result also." He says, "You have to be neutral as to whether or not the problem even gets solved." I said, "Well, if this problem doesn't get solved, we may lose the temple." He said, "Is it your temple?" I said, "Well, I care." He said, "You can care, but at the same time, you have to be detached." So I was thinking about, how do you do that? How do you care and be detached at the same time? How do you do that? Anybody have an idea how you do that? You leave the results up to Krishna. What does it mean that you care then? You do your best. You say, "Krishna, I'd like for this temple to stay here. I'd like to be, I'm trying to offer my service of having this temple stay here, or, you know, having the festival go on all right, or distributing 100 books out on Sankirtan today. But really, am I in control of that?"
Control their life.
love without control. In fact, Krishna talks about that in the Bhagavad Gita. He talks about that if you understand how he's neutral, you can also be neutral. Because Krishna loves everyone. In fact, Krishna loves us much more than anybody else can ever love us. Suranam Sarabhutam. There's no jiva who can ever love us the way Krishna loves us. Impossible. Krishna's traveling with us. Isra Sarabhutanam Riddhesharjitisthiti. Brahmayan Sarabhutanam Yantrulibhanamaya. He's traveling with us from body to body to body. You know, there's injunctions in the Shastra under which a guru can reject, should reject, must reject a disciple. But Krishna never rejects. Never. Even if you become a demon. So who loves more than Krishna? But he's neutral. He gives us our freedom, right? Krishna doesn't force. He doesn't say, you have to love me, you have to obey my rules. He lets us do things even that are bad for us. So yes, that's the difference between this attachment. Because Krishna is not trying to get anything from us. So one can have also that kind of detachment. Yes, I love the temple, I love the devotees. I love the service I'm doing. I care for them. I'm doing my best to serve them. But you know, whatever happens is Krishna is in control of that. As Prabhupada says, you know, if there's a profit, it's Krishna's profit. If there's a loss, it's Krishna's loss. It's not mine. So this giving up of the results to Krishna, that's very hard for a conditioned soul, because for a conditioned soul, our happiness is in the results. That's what we think our happiness is. Well, yeah, that's why I'm working the job. I'm working the job to make money. I'm not working the job just to work the job. I'm going to school to get the degree. You know, I'm doing something for the result, and I measure my happiness by how much I get the result. And I'm trying to squeeze my happiness out of the result. But the problem with that is, first of all, the results are just periodic. So then you're spending most of your time working for something in the future. So therefore, your quantity of happiness is very small. Then the results are not in your hands, so as we say, you're always in fear. And then probably at least half the time, the results are not what you wanted them to be. So how much happiness do you get when you're results-oriented? It's not really a very logical way to work. So the person who's detached from the result, who gives the results to Krishna, says, Krishna, these results are yours. Where are they getting their happiness from? Yes.
What is going to happen? I'm very happy because I'm engaging myself.
Yes, that. Yes, I read that also. It's a very wonderful example of what Krishna means here by giving up the results. What you're getting your pleasure from is the relationship with Krishna and the service you're doing with Krishna, not from the results. Of course, you want to offer Krishna nice results. You're not intending to offer Krishna banana peels. It's not your intention. Your intention is to offer Krishna the bananas. But even if you're offering ends up being banana peels, what you're getting your happiness from is that sharing of love with Krishna. You know, you're trying to dress yourself nicely to go to the festival, but if you're so excited to see Krishna that you put your sari on upside down, as Prabhupada would explain the gopis do, you know, and they put on one earring and half their makeup, and that's not a very pleasing result. But Krishna is actually very pleased when the gopis come all mixed up dressed like that. Why is he pleased? Yes, because they're so anxious to see him. What's more important to a young girl than how she's dressed? Not very many things. Right? I embarrassingly remember at 13 spending an hour, you know, fixing my hair. So for the young girl, that's, you know, she's not going to go out with one earring and half her makeup on and her clothes inside out and backwards. But that the girls were willing to do that out of their, they didn't even notice that they were doing it. Generally, you can say a man wants his lady friend to be nicely dressed. generally if there's some festival, is reading Krishna's birth, how everybody dresses up very nicely. But Krishna is not so much interested in that. He's interested in what's motivating it. What is the love? What's driving you? So the devotee is getting their happiness at every moment, regardless of the result. They know that the result will be good, as Prabhupada is saying, there's no contradiction in Krishna. They know the result will be good, ultimately, from Krishna's point of view, whether or not the result looks like it's good from my point of view. When Prabhupada lost the center in Jhansi, that looked like a big setback for his preaching. But it pushed Srila Prabhupada to leave India. So the result of the closing of the center in Jhansi was wonderful. But Prabhupada's happiness wasn't coming from, you know, well, do I have a center in Jhansi or not? His happiness is coming from, is Krishna pleased? And then you can be peaceful and fearless. Because you know what? We can please Krishna in any circumstance, at any moment, no matter what. We don't need a particular set of circumstances to please Krishna. We don't need things to go our way or the right way in order to please Krishna and have a relationship with him. We just don't. We can please Krishna just by seeing his form in our mind. We can please Krishna just by saying his name in our mind, even if we're paralyzed and can't speak. We don't need any, then we can have complete courage, complete fearlessness. It doesn't matter what happens. I was just reading Prabhupada saying this in teachings of Lord Kapila. The devotee doesn't care what happens. Where will I go next birth? That's another one of the big fears, right? Death. Where will I go? What will happen? How will I die? Will I suffer a death? The devotee doesn't care. His happiness, Prabhupada said, is not invested in the future. He knows Krishna will take care of him. Whatever Krishna does is good. Therefore, he can always be peaceful. Therefore, he can always be happy. Also, the devotee becomes fearless because he knows Krishna has taken his sinful reactions. Masuchaha, don't worry. Because we're suffering in this world because of our sins. But Krishna is saying, no, I'll deal with that. Therefore, whatever suffering the devotee gets is not due to their sinful reactions, as Prabhupada explains in the story in Krishna book about Vrikasura. Why do the devotees suffer? It may be a test. Who's arranging that suffering? Krishna personally. Krishna personally. So do good teachers or good parents sometimes do things that the students or the children perceive as suffering? Do you ever do something that your child thinks is suffering?
Yeah.
Of course. Why? You don't like your child, right? Why do you do those things?
To make it better.
Yes, to train your child out of love. For the benefit of your child. Not to harm your child. So, of course, I've never met, you know, the young child who goes to the parents or the teacher and says, thank you very much for taking away my toy. I know you're doing this out of love. You know, I haven't yet met that child. But that's the proper mood of the devotee. So the devotee has no fear. They're not thinking, oh, what's happening to me is just some random punishment or just some part of the, you know, whatever is happening to me, good or bad, is under Krishna's control and is for my benefit. And then another source of peace or fearlessness, of course, Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, is Bhaktiram Yagatapasam Sarvalokamahesham Suvanam Sarvabhutanam Gyatramam Shanti Muchichi. Because Shanti, peace, is the opposite of fear. You're saying the opposite of fear is fearlessness, courage, and peace. So how does that help? Because one is thinking, all right, Krishna's in control of everything, and he's my best friend. You know, if the person who runs everything is your best friend, do you have to worry about anything? I had this once in India where I was doing some service for one temple, and there was one devotee who was very, very wealthy who just facilitated everything. He bought my ticket to India. He bought my ticket inside India. He arranged for cars to drive me around. He said, thank you very much for the service you're doing here. How would you like to go to Vrindavan in Mayapur? I said, yeah. He said, okay, well, I have rooms there. You can, you know, stay in the rooms there for our family. And They arranged for someone to pick me up at the airport, to drive me to the rooms, to put me in the rooms. Everything was just taken care of. And I thought, that's what it's like to take shelter of Krishna. He's the most powerful. He has everything. And he's your best friend. He just takes care of you. You don't have to have any fear. Right? And also that Krishna's always with us. Sarvastra Chandramani Sanyi was told, he's always there. We're never in a situation where we're alone. We're on our own. We have to figure it out. We have to take care of ourselves. Fearlessness is mentioned as the first of the divine qualities, and Prabhupada talks about it, especially in relationship to sannyas. And he said, someone can't leave their family if they're thinking, how will I be supported? He said, we've been taking sannyas means you have no support nor any guarantee of support. You may be supported, you may not be supported. We read in Chaitanya Charitamrita how, you know, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was wandering through the forest and some days he's fasting. He might have been to Puri, some days he's fasting. Raghunath Das Goswami leaving his home, some days he's fasting. Some days there's a place to stay, some days there's not a place to stay. But one's thinking, Prabhupada says in that purport, that Krishna is always with me. If Krishna decides that I should not have a place to stay, well, then that must be what's best for me. If Krishna decides that I should fast today, well, then that must be what's best for me. If Krishna decides that everybody should throw stones at me like they did to Rishad Dev, then that must be what's best for me. He's here. He's right here. He's not just, you know, some far-off god. But he's right near, here next to me. And then Krishna says that one should conquer this fear by having a steady intelligence and steady mind. So all these things we've been talking about so far have been part of steady intelligence and steady mind. Therefore, in one sense, they've all been in the platform of Jnana Yoga. That one can analyze things. All right, well, I'm not really this body. I'm never going to die. Krishna's taking care of me. He's right here. He's really the proprietor of everything. I don't have control of the results anyway. But there's also a limit as to how much courage and peace one can get just through Jnana Yoga. Why is there a limit as to how much courage and peace you can have just through Jnana Yoga? Yes, there's still something selfish in it, isn't it? In fact, even the desire for peace for one's own happiness is selfish. And because it's selfish, then there's again a tipping point where you're going to feel fearfulness. Oh, something's going to disrupt my peace. Something's going to disrupt my detachment. Because the way that you become full of courage and peacefulness again is to a sense of detachment. But can one always be detached? Again, one can be detached until something comes along that is more than your detachment can handle, that threatens you. Then the detachment is finished. And is our purpose just to be detached? No. So ultimate courage and ultimate peace, which sometimes manifests as anxiety, like Mother Yasoda, you know, worrying that Krishna is going to die in the Yamuna, strangled by the Kaliya's wound. That comes from something else. Bhakti mama vijananti yavanyas chasmitattata tatomam tatpato nattva vishate tadamantana. That comes from love. And again, we all have a little perversion of that in this world. The child is running in front of the car and the mother runs in front of traffic to save the child and she has no fear. She's not worried. Is a car going to hit me? Or you read about, you know, people who fall down in the, in America they call it the subway, in the UK they call it the underground. You know, they fall down in the tracks. You understand what I mean? Trains that run under the ground in the city. Sometimes somebody stumbles and falls on the tracks and some bystander just jumps in and rescues them. The bystander could be killed. But why do they have courage? If you really love somebody, then you're willing to do anything to experience that loving relationship with them. And you have no fear. Confirmed. It just doesn't matter. You're willing to do anything. And there's all sorts of songs like that. I remember one song, there's no mountain too high and no river too wide and whatever, that will keep me from getting to you. Who sings? So there's these sort of, people express these sort of sentiments. And to some extent, they'll do it. You know, people will fight wars. They'll take all kinds of risks. They'll risk their reputation. They'll risk their money. They'll risk their standing in the community. They'll risk their health. They'll risk dying for love, don't they? Don't people do that? They'll even do that for love of a dog. We'll just speak of love of their wife or love of their child. But that's another kind of peace. It's not just sort of the Om Shanti Shanti sort of peace. But it's another kind of peace. It's a sort of inner peace and centeredness and happiness that, hey, as long as I'm with Krishna and as long as I have a loving relationship with Krishna, then it just doesn't matter. I'll do anything. Now, obviously, that can't be imitated. You know, sometimes devotees hear these things and they think, okay, I'll just do anything for Krishna. But they're not really acting out of love. And then when anything happens, they get angry. But at least we can understand this principle, that the only thing we really need to do is love Krishna. Really, all the gyan in the Shastra is not meant to bring us to gyan yoga, where we're just like detached persons. It's meant to bring us to love. That as I read these things about the material world and Krishna's nature, I fall in love with him so much that I have full courage. Not only am I willing to have virtues under all circumstances, I'm willing even to abandon my virtues, not for my own interest, but for Krishna's, if he wants me to. If Krishna says, hey, I know you made a promise to Duryodhan, but now fight on the Pandava side, you know, Karna became fearful. What will happen to me? I'll lose my reputation. I'll go to hell. I'll suffer. I can't do that. That's unethical. But if one's in love with Krishna, then there's no question. There's no point at which you say, okay, I'm not going to do this anymore. So this is the only way really to be happy, is to have courage. It's the only way to be a good person under all circumstances. It's the only way to be happy at every moment, in every circumstance. It's the only way to find peace. It's really the only way to find everything that we want. Where we're completely detached from the results, we're completely detached from whatever happens in the world, whatever happens to our body, as long as Krishna's happy. As long as I have that loving relationship with Krishna. So again, as I said, we can't imitate this, but what we can do is we can take some area in our life that we're holding on to with attachment and fear. And I should also mention that anger is very connected to this. Attachment, fear, and anger. In fact, almost all anger is fear-based. Generally, when something is, because we're attached to something, we're afraid of losing it, and out of that fear, we become angry. If you notice next time you get angry, try to identify what's the underlying fear. It's quite an interesting exercise. But we can take something that we're attached to, that we have a lot of fear about, and give it to Krishna. You can try it with a little thing at first, so it's not too scary. You know, something. You could just even do it for a few days. I think I mentioned before, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says it's good to take a vow first for 3 days. He says then 1 month, then 3 months. But you can also do it a little, you know. You could also do 3 days, then maybe a week, then 2 weeks, then a month. Doing that, by the way, pacifies the mind. If you say to the mind, okay, I'm going to acknowledge that this is in Krishna's hand for the rest of my life, the mind may say, you can't do that. All these terrible things will happen. You say, okay, I'll do it for 3 days. And then the mind says, okay, I'll do it for 3 days. If the mind complains, you say, after 3 days, you can go ahead and be scared about this again. So you take whatever it may be, you know, how's it going to work out with my marriage? how's it going to happen to my kid? What's going to happen to my money? What's going to happen to my education? What's going to happen to my learning facility? What's going to happen to my relationship with this person? And see, try giving it to Krishna. Say, Krishna, you know, I'm going to do my best here, but whatever happens is, if that's your business, and I'm going to be peaceful. And I'm going to be content just with pleasing you. And I'll see if I can do that for 3 days. For 3 days, I'll put this in your hands. And you may find after the 3 days, you say, well, that was really nice. Boy, man, the quality of my life is so much improved. All right, Lord, I'll take a vow for a week. That for 1 week, I'm going to just let you handle. I'm going to do my service. I'm going to do my best. I'm going to do my duty, as Prabhupada says in that, in teachings of Lord Kapila. He said, one is dutiful. I'm going to do my duty. But I'm not going to get my happiness from the results. I'm going to get my happiness from pleasing you. And after a week, you might say, well, that was nice. In fact, you might not even notice when the week is up. And you just could keep doing it. And you say, wait a minute, my vow expired and I'm still depending on Krishna. How is that? Well, maybe I'll try it for another month. Or maybe I'll try it for another 3 months. And gradually one sees this life of Krishna consciousness is really nice. It's a really sweet thing. I can be in the world and not of the world. I can be even taking on so many anxieties and responsibilities for Krishna and still maintain that inner core of courage and fearlessness and satisfaction. I will no longer think that Krishna is a snake. I'll see that he's a rope, he's benign, and that there's really nothing, the only thing there is to fear is my own attachment and my own illusion. So questions, comments, additions, subtractions? Yes?
Everything you say there is correct. Sometimes people use this understanding as a way to absolve themselves from putting other people into difficulty, for example, and say, you know, we hear it all the time about Krishna's arrangements, Krishna's arrangements. And it is, in a sense, but sometimes absolves the person from personal responsibility for their sinful behavior. And also on the other side of the coin, if we see everything as Krishna's arrangement, it might also stifle our ability to praise other devotees for the good things they do.
Okay, so you made two very good points. You say if we just say that everything is, all the results are done by Krishna, then we might not take responsibility if we do something that harms others. Is that the first point? And the second point is then we might not give credit to people who do something good. Did you notice that we're only afraid of not taking, you're not afraid that we will stop taking responsibility for the good things? Did you notice that?
Sorry,
I'm not saying you, but this is in general, that we're not afraid that, oh, if I take this philosophy, I'll stop taking responsibility for the good things I do. You follow? You're saying, oh, if we take this philosophy, we'll no longer take responsibility for when I harm others. But nobody says, well, if I take this philosophy, I'll no longer feel that I have any credit for when I do good to others. I've never heard anybody give that objection. And you're saying, I may not praise others when they do good. But again, nobody ever says, well, if we take this philosophy, then I may not, you know, ever blame anybody anymore. So we're worried about ourselves getting blamed and others getting praised. Isn't that interesting? Just sort of note that. So even though I say Krishna is a doer, why do I still feel that I have some responsibility when things turn out well? Okay, I went out there, distributed 150 Bhagavad Gitas and 200 Srimad Bhagavatams. Now, I know Krishna did it. I know I'm not in control of that because the day before, I only did one Bhagavad Gita and I couldn't do any Bhagavatams. So what's that sense that I feel, you know, when people say, wow, you did so many books? I may say, yeah, Krishna did it. But inside, I also feel something. Why? I feel appreciated. But also, what's that happiness I'm feeling? A good happiness, a genuine spiritual good happiness. What's that coming from?
You acted as Krishna's servant.
Yes, I acted as Krishna's servant. So it works the other way too. It's the same thing. So let's say that I do my best effort and the results are something that's pleasing. Then I'm also happy with that. I'm happy acting as Krishna's instrument in that way. If I'm acting to my best of my ability as Krishna's instrument and the results are not pleasing, then I can express my sorrow over the fact that the results are not pleasing. I can celebrate or I can mourn. But I'm not taking personal responsibility in the sense that I think that I'm the only doer. Because I'm not. And then we'll get to the other question. Yes,
in psychology, there's a term called fundamental attributional error.
Oh my goodness. Are we all supposed to remember that? Fundamental attributional error. Okay.
Yeah, and what this is that when we make a mistake, then we always apply that to external factors. Yeah, I'm late because there's lots of traffic. I'm late because. And when someone else makes a mistake, we always ascribe it or attribute it to character flaws. And so it's just a common thing. We never apply the character flaw explanation to ourselves and never give the benefit of the doubt as to external witnesses to other people.
Yes, and I don't know if you were here for that, but I was saying that I was just dealing with that in some mediation where I was telling the different parties exactly this point. And I was saying that if other people harm you, then you should assume that they have good intentions and that it's not due to a character flaw. And I was feeling frustrated with how difficult it was to have that work. You know, everybody would agree. And then as soon as they would start fighting again, it would be gone. I mean, they'd say, yes, yes, everyone has... And we could talk about it theoretically. And the moment that somebody would say or do something, it was gone. And I was asking Krishna why, and then he let me experience it personally, and I saw how hard it was. That as soon as somebody was coming at me and criticizing me, immediately I wanted to just criticize their character mentally. You know, immediately I wanted to criticize their character. I wanted to argue with the system they were propounding. I wanted to blame them in some way. And yet, yeah, when I do harm to others, I want to say, oh, it's your fault for perceiving that it's harmful. But I think if I'm doing something that causes harm, I can look at my motives. To what extent am I really acting as Krishna's instrument? But then I can also mourn with the person and comfort them. There's an example of Rupa Goswami, who was meditating on Krishna's Leela, and he saw something funny in Krishna's Leela and started laughing in his meditation. And right at that moment, are you allowed to say deformed anymore in modern society anyway? A structurally challenged person walked by. And that person thought that Rupa Goswami was laughing at his deformity. And Rupa Goswami's meditation broke. And he could understand that something's happened that Krishna's not pleased with. So he was able to ascertain the cause, and he apologized to the person for being an instrument of pain for them. So certainly the devotee has, but he's not... Rupa Goswami isn't thinking, you know, oh, I did this. You know, I have to go around feeling guilty and that kind of thing. Yes?
And I'd like to clarify an understanding I have about Krishna taking the sin of the devotee. So, at the moment, I understand that in terms of according to the quality of the devotee, then that Krishna takes the sin of the devotee. Is that correct?
It's an interesting question, because in Tathāgata Kampam, Lord Brahma says that the devotee does consider his suffering to be his own doing. And yet at the same time, we're told over and over and over again that as soon as one surrenders to Krishna, everything's under Krishna's control. Yes, Findu Gopam with the Vendra Mahoswa Karma, Bandana Rupapala Bhajana Madhimati, Karma Dinir Jahati Kimchita Bhakti Bhajan. And Lord Ramachandra says when Vibhishan surrenders, one of the most wonderful stories in the Shastra, Vibhishan surrender. And everyone else is saying, don't accept him. And he says, the moment that someone surrenders unto me, from that moment they become my personal ward. And there's one statement quoted in Nectar of Devotion, the same from Lord Nisingadeva. And Yamaraj says that if somebody one time bows their head to the Lord, that that person is no longer under the jurisdiction of Yamaraj, they're under Krishna's personal control. And that doesn't just apply to people in the Hare Krishna movement. That would apply to anybody who, you know, one time said, with sincerity, from this day on, Lord, I am yours. Or we're talking here about courage. Ramachandra says specifically, if somebody one time says to me, I surrender to you, please give me courage. He says, I immediately award courage to such a person. So my understanding is the moment that we surrender to Krishna, we're no longer under the jurisdiction of Yamaraj. Even if some of the things that are happening to us are the same or very similar as to what would be happening to us as our sinful reactions. But they're administered differently. Prabhupada says the difference is in the punishment administered by a mother and the punishment administered by an enemy. And my own understanding of that is that I ran a school for many years where the children were put in different subjects according to their individual ability. So we give each child a diagnostic test. That generally in schools, if you're 8 years old, you're in this class and you learn this thing. And you're 9 years old, you're in this class and learn this thing. Doesn't matter what you know. But in my school, I gave them a test. So if a child was, you know, in one level in mathematics and another level in English, they'd be at different levels. So it was very individually administered. However, some children, even if you're giving them an individual test, will still be at the same place they would have been in a school that did everything by age. So it may look the same. It may look exactly the same. And what happens to a devotee may be exactly the same as what would have happened to them under karma. But it's being administered differently. I mean, and one other difference is that, let's say a child who was 8 scored at knowing what most 8-year-olds know for mathematics. They'd be put into that regular thing. But I'm also watching them individually. And I see if they need more help, I may give them certain things. If they can go on, I'll give them other things. I'm tailoring. I'm placing them individually, and I'm tailoring it individually. Whereas in most schools, it's not like that. Everybody open up your books to page 23, put your finger on problem number 6. You know, it doesn't matter. And if you say to the teacher, I already know this, teacher, too bad we're all doing this together. You know, and it's like that in the legal system, too. If you commit a crime, the judge has a certain leeway. For some crimes, they have no leeway. For some crimes, hey, you do this crime, that's it, you have life imprisonment. And other crimes, there's a range of punishments they can give you. And for some crimes, the judge can say, you just do community service. They have a certain degree of power. Right? But they don't have absolute power. They're under the law. Whereas the head of the country or the head of the state, they can say, whatever. They're functioning above the law. So it could be that the head of the state will put you in jail for 25 years and you would have gotten put in jail for 25 years anyway. But it's completely different. So I understand that happens immediately, as soon as somebody surrenders to Krishna. That's not just a function of absolute purity. Then on the other hand, if I'm not very pure, I'm still experiencing material attachments, which you can say is the root of sin, and I'm suffering due to my attachment. So in that way, you could say that an impure devotee is still suffering because of sin. But that's a little different.
It's not the instigation of pure devotional service, it's not necessarily the one is advanced in it.
Yes. At least according to those statements of Ramachandra and Nisingadeva and in the Brahma Samhita.
So it's from the moment that the person instigates the mood and quality of pure devotional service, then from that point, Krishna
is personally in charge of that person.
And that person may be bowing down in the temple with that mood, and that's awakening for the first time from that point, Krishna's. And then someone else is coming along and just bowing down.
That's right. That's right. That's right. So you could do all the rituals and the externals, and if you've never had that mood of my dear Lord, from this day on I am yours. Yes, it's what's described as a mood of somebody who says, okay, Lord, I belong to you. I'm yours. I surrender to you. That may not be said at a mature level of surrender, but it's mature for that person at that point. It's total surrender for that person at that point. Yes.
Is it possible that the material nature would be crucial, like kind of models of material nature?
Well, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati talking about initiation, which is of course later for most people, although not necessarily so, says that once one has taken initiation from a bona fide spiritual master, he will definitely be delivered. He says that there may be very, very, very rare cases where that is not so. So there might be an extremely rare case where a person having made that sort of commitment then ends up just being under the control of the illusory energy again. Might there be some time when someone's temporarily put under the control of the illusory energy? I don't know. I mean, shastrically speaking, Krishna says that from that moment on, that person is his personal lord. So I'd have to say that even if that's apparently so, Krishna is still keeping a personal eye on that person differently than they would otherwise. You know, even if somebody's in jail and they say, okay, I want to reform myself, I want to be a good prisoner. So there, first there's a program in the jail for reform. And then at a certain point, and you may even start then teaching other prisoners, you know, once you're in that reform program for a while. Then after a while, they let you out on parole, or not parole, but they let you out on probation. Now when you're out on probation, you're out of the jail, but you still have to check in with the jailers periodically, and if you violate the rules of your probation, then again you're back in jail. Then at a certain point, you're out on parole, so you're really just out. But you still have a criminal record. People haven't quite forgotten that you have, you know, there's still something there. You're not 100% free. So if we think about going from Shraddha to Prema, so in Nista, Nasta Prayasya Bhadrasya Nicha Bhagavata Sevaya, you're almost free. You're not really free. You're almost free. The material nature still kind of has her eye on you and is watching you. And it's certainly possible. It's not likely, but it's certainly possible if you mess up. And even we find people at Bhava, like Bhavamangala Thakur and Bharat Maharaj, who sometimes, again, apparently come under the control of the illusory energy. So that's certainly possible. But my understanding is even if that happens, you're still under Krishna's personal jurisdiction. So even if he says, okay, all right, back to the prison house, he's still got your dossier in his personal file. You know, which he doesn't have for the conditioned souls in general. For the conditioned souls in general, he's the neutral, he's the witness. My Devi, you're taking care of him. You know, so that's what I understand from that. I'm sure other people would have different explanations. But even if the devotee is thinking that I'm suffering because of my sin, my ultimate sin is a rebellion to Krishna, and therefore I deserve to suffer, and I'm happy to take that suffering as Krishna gives me, still he has no fear with that suffering. Because he knows that Krishna's personally engineering it, and that therefore it's for his benefit. Whereas the suffering as an ordinary conditioned soul is for their benefit in a very theoretical, long-term way. It's not really for their immediate benefit. It's just part of the general system. Their suffering and their enjoyment has an ultimate purpose, but not in an immediate sense. And just to get back to the second half of your question, if we see that Krishna's in control, will I stop praising people when they do well? Well, only if you stop blaming people when they do badly. And since I don't think that that's going to happen. You know, we often, if somebody does something good, we say, oh, it's Krishna. And if someone does something bad, we say, oh, it's them. So you see both as Krishna, and you see both as them also. And the example that I give is I'm sure everybody here has had an experience like that. How the one day I was looking in my closet and thought, I could use another silk sari. Yeah, I'd like it to be beige with an embroidered border and kind of a really heavy silk. And maybe next time I go to India, I'll buy one. Nah, it'll cost me at least $40. I'm not going to spend $40 of Krishna's money. I'm sorry, you know. What I have is enough. What a stupid idea. And 3 days later, when mother was picking up her daughter from the school, hey, Ramila, I got something for you. And she hands me exactly the picture I had in my head. Exactly. I mean, I started crying. But I didn't say thank you to her. I didn't go to her and say, you know, oh, Golokananda Priya, that was just Krishna who did it. You didn't do that. I mean, that's ridiculous. Of course I thanked her. She also did it. I saw it. I knew it was Krishna. I was actually really embarrassed. It's like, Krishna, I'm sorry. But I also thanked her. I said, wow, thank you for giving me this. I can't believe you gave this to me. I was very grateful. So I don't, you know. We're willing to see it the other way. When someone does something that bothers me, you know, you did it. Oh, it was Krishna. Yeah, but you were the instrument. Give person the credit for being the instrument and give Krishna the ultimate credit. Is that all right? Do you see how hesitant we are to give the results to Krishna? Isn't it interesting? We really hold on to this idea that I can't give the results to Krishna. And therefore we're holding on to our fear. Our mind has so many really solid logical arguments for why I can't give the results to Krishna. Why I can't take happiness just in the moment-to-moment relationship. So you can say to your mind, my dear mind, you are also part of Krishna's energy. You're also part of Krishna's energy. You're meant to help me to serve Krishna. You're meant to be my friend. Please give me nice logical arguments about how I can surrender all the results to Krishna so that I can be happy and peaceful. Please help me. And if you're not going to help me, I'm going to beat you with a stick. And if that doesn't work, I'm going to completely ignore you and just give all the results to Krishna anyway. I'm going to try it for a few days at least, and I'm just going to see whether or not I'm actually happy or peaceful and whether or not I have some courage. And if it works, I'm not going to listen to you anymore. Yes?
You know, like I'm going to say to my mind, I'm going to beat you with a stick, and I'm like, you're my friend, but you don't do my work.
Shastra compares the mind to a wild animal. Did you ever take care of a wild animal? Who here has ever taken care of a wild animal? Anybody? No one here has ever taken care of a wild animal. Well, I did. We were at the temple in Detroit, and they're a little different than the ones you have here, I think. But there was a mama opossum, and she had 12 little babies on her back, and one of them fell off. And opossums are not very advanced creatures. So she didn't even notice that it fell off, but it was crying. And the students in the school, they all said, oh, mother, there's a little baby opossum that's been abandoned by its mother. So can we take it to the school and take care of it? So, all right. My son, one of my sons, in his description of himself, he said, I never had a pet, but we once did take care of a baby opossum. So we took this opossum back to the school. And we got a little bottle to feed it milk, and we fed it milk and we took care of it. And guess what happened as soon as this opossum grew up a little bit? What do you think it started to do? It started to bite. So we had taken care of it. We had been its mommy. We had given it a warm place to stay and clean water to drink. It used to use the clean water bowl as its toilet. You know, we had given it everything. And as soon as it grew up, just a little bit, it started hissing. We'd come near it and go, ah. I thought, well, you're not a very grateful species, are you? And as soon as it was big enough for it to take care of itself, we let it loose in the woods. So the Shastra says that the mind is like a wild animal. You don't trust it. You don't trust it. You know? You can't trust the mind. Or another example would be a very young child, like a one-year-old child. You don't trust that the child's going to do the right thing. You don't just say, oh, go outside and play while I take a nap. Who knows what the kid is going to do? Or in your house, Any of us parents know what happens when you don't watch your 1.5-year-old kid. Oh, they're quiet. First-time parents, Oh, they're quiet. Good. They must be happily playing in the next room. I can get something done. Right? All of us who have kids, you know the scenario. And then you go look in the next room, you're like, oh my God. You find that they found a bottle of oil and spilled it all over the floor and unwrapped all the toilet tissue and mixed that with the oil and got into your kumkum and that's all over the floor and it's painted on the walls like finger painting. And so you can't trust the 1 or 2 year old child. So you can't trust them. The mind's function. Of course, everything in this world exists for two functions, but the main function of the material mind and intelligence is to protect the false ego, to guard the false ego. You can't surrender to Krishna. If you surrender to Krishna, there will be so many problems. You'll start hating your friends if you surrender to Krishna. You'll no longer take responsibility for the bad things you do if you surrender to Krishna. You will no longer appreciate people who do good things if you surrender to Krishna. Don't surrender to Krishna. That's the mind's job. When the intelligence is, oh, that's all true. In fact, I know somebody who thought they were surrendering to Krishna and they had all those problems. So don't do it. You can look like you're surrendering to Krishna. You can go through the motions and chant your rounds and bow down. You can do all that, but don't really surrender to Krishna. What might happen? And all those terrible things that Krishna does for the people who surrender to him. He takes away their wealth. He takes away their family. They become completely neglected. They have no shelter. They go through the forest and they're fasting for days and they drink bad water and they get itchy sores all over their body. And they have to walk on the sands and their feet get all blistered. All these terrible things happen. Don't surrender, Krishna. Just don't do it, okay? And we go, yes, mind, whatever you say. I am your obedient servant. I'm so glad I have you here to take care of me. What would I do without you? I might become happy and blissful and go back to Godhead. So, you got to deal with the mind like that. You got to just say to the mind, please be quiet. And if the mind keeps biting, then we had to sometimes take the apostle and put him in a cage. We were still nice to our friends, don't worry. Even though I put the apostle in the cage, I didn't put my friends in a cage. So, nothing to worry about. But anyway, I have all these fears too, what can I say? I'm not picking on anything. This is our basic reason. We were talking last night at the program, why don't we surrender to Krishna? So, but the mind can also be our friend. But the mind can be our friend if we're in control. You don't want to let a two-year-old run the household. You don't want to let the two-year-old dictate the menus. Imagine if you had your two-year-olds dictating the menus. Be all sweets. And the two-year-old dictates what you do all day. So, it's not the two-year-old is a slave, but not that you let them be in control. So the mind is just like that. The mind is really just like a two-year-old or like some wild opossum. Respect them as Krishna's energy, but we're meant to harness that and have it under our control. Is that all right? At the stage of Ashakti, at the stage of Ashakti, the mind is a very good friend. So that's like a grown-up child. So when your two-year-old gets to be 25, then they're a very good friend, and they even take care of you in your old age. So at the stage of Ashakti, the mind is your friend. Even if there's something that would distract you from Krishna, your mind immediately goes back to Krishna. But until that time, be careful. Even if your mind is a teenager, be careful. Wait till they're grown up before you trust them.